got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, how's your face this week?
Minus a tooth. But it's nice because there's a gap there now and I can open bottles without a bottle opener.
And that's what life is all about, really, is when you sit down with a beer and you don't have a bottle opener.
and you don't want to break the glass, right? Or most normal people just buy cans and then that gets around that problem, too. But all's well. It just was really a bad, like having something wrong with a tooth and then having it get into nerves, and because the medication is as bad as the problem, and you end up, you know, taking antibiotics and decolonizing your large intestine and all the things that have to happen to get back to normal. Trying to find a good fecal transplant around here.
Yeah, it's weird. I can't find a good clinic for that either in my neighborhood.
Well, you can find people who are willing to do it, but for like $5. But then you go, with COVID and everything, I think I'd just pass.
Yeah, that's what it is. Of all the things that would stop me from doing that, that's the, Anyways, let's dive into some stories, and we've got some good ones, including a little bit of controversy. So starting off, will cancel culture claim Charles Darwin? It's already silenced several academics, both living and already deceased. So we're going to look a little bit closer at that as well. Next up, food documentaries like Cowspiracy and GMO OMG. What a name. These are very popular on Netflix right now, but they're also loaded with bad science, according to a former organic farmer. And then finally, anti-GMO groups are trying to block the release of a biotech chestnut tree that very well could save the American chestnut tree. And their arguments, it seems to us at least, leave a lot to be desired. And so we're going to examine those as well. But tell us about this first story, Kevin.
Yeah, will cancel culture claim Darwin? And this is written by Jerry Coyne, who is a very well-established evolutionary biologist. I love his books. He wrote this article asking the question on his own blog, asking this question about Darwin, because Darwin, like many in the time, had opinions that were based upon his views as an evolutionary biologist. I guess they didn't call it back then, but he was taking a look at biology and social norms and different societies and different groups and making inferences that probably would get him in a lot of trouble today. And when you look at it, it does smack of eugenics. But what Coyne really talks about is that Darwin, you know, when you read through some of his books, you read through The Descent of Man was the one that was the big one, because he would talk about different societies of savages, you know, talk about the American Indians in ways that were rather derogatory. But throughout the entire text, he always kept it very scientific in that he would say, well, the brain case of this group is larger than the brain case of this group, you know. But nonetheless, these were really kind of harbingers of eugenics that would follow in the next, you know, 20, 30, 50 years. And what Coyne points out is that even though a lot of others, including political figures, have gone through cancel culture, they kind of have spared Darwin. And maybe it was because he came from a family of abolitionists. They were not slave owners. They didn't want to be. They were against slavery. But for some reason, we've kind of looked the other way for Darwin.
So I think it's they're sort of expecting that it could happen based on what's happened to some other really prominent figures in philosophy and in the sciences, like David Hume, for example. I wasn't aware of this, but apparently David Hume, the philosopher, has fallen victim to cancel culture, I guess, in Europe, or people are trying to get some of his statues pulled down. So based on, I suppose, other prominent figures from that time period, they're saying it's very likely that this could happen to Darwin. And what was interesting to me is that it's really not based on his work to the extent that his theory of evolution is correct. They've just found a few phrases. And I think, as you've pointed out, most people today would say, well, yeah, that's obviously ridiculous and we don't abide by what he's saying here, but nonetheless, his work is correct. And so it seems to me we should be able to say, let's eat the meat and spit out the bones. You know, his work was good overall. However, he said some things that were clearly conditioned by the time he was living in, and we can just say we don't go with that anymore.
Yeah, and that's where we kind of have to think about all these questions is that, you know, people may have been good and the times were bad and their opinions reflected some of the conventions and the conventional wisdom of the time. That was wrong. Yet we didn't have the resources we have today to be able to check ourselves so well. And so you may be very prone to believing something that you were always told or that you always read. And even things that we look at today and say, wow, this is really absolutely awful. Like one of the things he was talking about was from Descent of Man, where he would talk about the hideous ornaments and hideous music admired by the savages. that was somebody's something, you know, and imagine what he would say today.
Imagine the Facebook apology.
but that's the thing when I read about this and I think about this kind of cancel culture is what will they say when they tear down our statues? What did Cameron and Kevin do or say or whatever that will get us removed from the future? And it could be something as simple as they used internal gas combustion engines when they knew that there was carbon dioxide increasing the temperature of the earth. Who in their right mind would do such a thing, you know? And it's just the way that things are now, even though they're not right, they're what we do. And it really made me start thinking about this in the broader context of cancel culture and the standards that we're holding. You know, Darwin was a great scientist, and it is unfortunate that some of these words that he has used, you know, it came from his quill, that they will be used against him going forward.
And I get that, and I understand that. But from my vantage point, I know of no one who works in evolutionary biology or any of the popular defenders of Darwinian evolution, like Richard Dawkins or, you know, Christopher Hitchens, who's no longer with us. But any of these folks, at no point in their careers have they got on a stage and said, you know, repeated what he said in his books. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like we're capable of differentiating a bad idea from a good idea. It's just not that hard to do in my mind. And it bugs me that we're sort of deviating from that standard. And we're just doing this sort of emotion based reaction. I just don't understand, because if we go with that, then we could literally dismiss all of history. We could find, if you go back to like ancient Rome, for example, you can find so many examples. Slavery is a great one, right? I mean, this is probably the greatest empire that's ever existed. And slavery was a thing. And we can say that's abhorrent, but at the same time, we can look at all of the great things that came out of Rome and say, well, those things are good. Let's keep those. And I don't like the trend that I see here, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's kind of inverse cherry picking. It's going through somebody's history to find a reason to dismiss the good things they did, so that you don't have to pay credence to them. And I guess that's maybe the reason that Darwin isn't going down, is because there's not a lot of people who get too upset about evolution. But if it was somebody working in vaccines or genetic engineering, then probably these kinds of statements would be something that they would say, well, look at, you know, what a scumbag he was. We shouldn't believe anything he says. And, you know, ask me how I know. And I mean, that's the kind of modern cancel culture cherry picking that goes about to remove the voice of people who have important things that are controversial.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And you have some firsthand experience with this.
Yeah. Been there, done that, yeah.
Some of the pictures I've seen online of you, they, like, distort your forehead, and they put a cigar wrapped, like, made of dollar bills in your mouth. It's like the craziest
stuff. And my forehead doesn't need distortion. You could you could show a movie on that thing as it is. And there's a lot of that on there. I always say that when I teach a class, you know, I'll say, first thing we do is, before we get too far into this, is go do Google Images on your laptop or your phone, and let's answer any questions you have right up front. Because, you know, the worst thing in the world is lecturing to a class and them passing around a laptop showing, you know, something and laughing about it. You know, you got to be up front with this stuff because it is a real thing. And to, you know, I think that's the beauty of it, is that Darwin is insulated from that because he's not a controversial figure anymore. And so people are probably willing to look the other way at some of his conventions of the time. And that's probably what will happen.
Yeah. Well, here's hoping. I just, in a general sense, I really hope that more of the science community stands up against this sort of reaction that we're seeing. And I know the book Cynical Theories just came out by Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay. And they both have science backgrounds, if my understanding is correct. And they just go through and they just say, look, you know, I mean, some of this stuff just doesn't make sense. And we're doing ourselves a disservice if we're going to let this overtake our scientific thinking in the modern world. So I just hope that people continue, like this article, I hope people continue to publish stuff like this.
That's really true. And because the internet changes everything, and that you can, this art book came out back when if the internet was available back in Darwin's time, and people had a chance to seize upon those little nuggets and make those largely represent who he is and what he was about, then it would be a very different story. And that's really what modern cancel culture is about. It doesn't matter what you do in your lifetime of work. If you can seize on some little thread that you can use to grab and unravel somebody, that's where it goes wrong. And it's facilitated by the internet. So scientists need to be stepping into these conversations better and making sure that we keep those threads like Darwin's sewn into that fabric, because it's really important that that people continue to recognize his work.
Very good. Well, let's talk about bad documentaries.
Oh man, this is a good week.
Yes.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this article, and the article was originally written by Jonathan Lawler for Ag Daily. And Jonathan was a farmer. His family farmed for years. He was moved to the city, but then came back to the agricultural roots. And he and his wife produced mountains of conventional fruits and vegetables for farmers markets. And he would bring them to urban farmers markets, and people would say, is this organic? And he would say, no, it's a wonderful conventional product I made. And people would turn their nose up at it and walk away, to the point where he ended up going back and creating and becoming an organic farmer. And when they would ask him, do you use pesticides? He would tell them about the pesticides he used. And he was wrapped up in the experiencing firsthand the confusion around what does organic mean. And he was a victim of the organic halo that he later went on to exploit. And it was that unique standpoint that gave him pause when he would start to look at documentaries around food and farming. And he raises a really good point. When you watch a documentary on crocodiles, you learn that they stalk their prey, that they lay in wait for, you know, something to come walking along and then kill it, that they've got powerful jaws and, you know, all the things that about the facts of crocodiles. They don't describe them as evil and greedy and, you know, destructive. They describe them as what they are. Yet when you go to farming and food documentaries, it all becomes a teardown. And they don't just talk about how you grow food. They talk about how it's poisoning a planet. And he drills down on a couple different examples here in this article. It's really worth checking out. But it really does draw to question about why these documentaries are being so well accepted, both on Netflix and sometimes in our schools.
I want to read that quote that you alluded to because it's pretty funny and I think it sets up the rest of the article. So he says, consider a National Geographic documentary on crocodiles. You don't walk away saying those crocodiles are evil and greedy. Why do they kill so many buffalo? And why do they trick them by pretending to be logs?
Yeah.
Of course you don't, because the documentary director is just, well, documenting. And I think that's exactly the point. And he goes on and he gives some examples that we can get into, but they tend to prize anecdotal stories, and he gives the archetypal characters that maybe we can talk about those. And then they take the frame of a documentary and then they just shove all of their ideological baggage into it and present it like it's just gospel truth. It drives me nuts. Anyways.
But that's exactly the point, is that they're using the format of a documentary and the film style of documentary to give almost a narrative that is highly biased and uses elements of storytelling. And as you say, you know, heroes, victims, and villains, to promote basically another industry, a different food industry. I don't know. I saw GMO OMG. I actually watched it as part of a panel. And oh yeah, that was sweet. I was the representative scientist, and it was me, and I was on the panel with like a crystal healer, a guy from Occupy Monsanto, Orlando. It was like an organic seed, an organic farmer, and a couple other folks. And the organic farmer, they're all sweet people. The organic farmer guy was complaining that Monsanto GMO lettuce had contaminated all of his lettuce and that he couldn't grow it anymore. It just didn't grow. And I said, they don't make GMO lettuce. There's no such thing. That's what they're telling you, paying you to say. It was so wild. And, but anyway, that's the problem with these particular level of documentaries, Cowspiracy, GMO OMG, all the other ones that, What the Health, all the other ones that Jeffrey Smith is on. These are really propaganda tools being disguised as informational movies. And that's what makes them really dangerous and misleading.
And he talks about these characters that show up in the films. I'm going to bring up the article so I can get these correct. But he talks about, you know, there was this farmer, there's usually some kind of farmer, and then he wakes up and he recognizes the error of his ways, and then he converts his whole operation to organic, and life's just better, and there's no machinery on his farm, and there's no yucky chemicals anywhere, and it's basically heaven on earth. And then this guy in the article, which is really interesting, he says, you know, I tried all that stuff and my productivity went down drastically. And he was growing food, I think, as you said, for food kitchens in urban settings. And he couldn't produce as much food as he wanted to when he was growing that way. And I think that's such a great contrast between the reality and the story that they are telling. And I don't know. Maybe it's just because I just know the subject so well, but I just don't understand how people believe this. Maybe it's just because this is their only exposure to it.
Well, that's what it is. It's the complete ignorance of where your food comes from that allow the myth to be perpetuated. The fact that people believe that, farming is a pretty easy thing to do. You know, I've said 1,000 times here, you know, my wife farms and, you know, she's out there 16 hours a day, but you get, people who she'll hire somebody who wants to help out or whatever. They come here, they spend about 3 hours out in the 95 degree heat pulling weeds, and they go, you know what? I'm out of here. And they have like this really pastoral view of what this is. And when they realize this is just really bloody hard work, it turns them off. But it's just that people don't understand what farming is. They don't understand what farmers do. And if they did understand it, they would see that sometimes a little herbicide goes a long way compared to having to manually do that work.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's so many gems in this. I want to read another quote because it just for your edification, everybody, there's no editorializing coming. So he says, the formula goes something like this. The first character introduced is a conventional farmer turned organic. Environment first, profit second. No tractors or technology to be found on this homestead. Character number two is a vegan activist who was on the verge of death by eating meat and dairy. And then they switched to veganism and are now living their best life. And then the final one he talks about, I don't have to read the whole thing, but there's a third character, and this is the tech guru who decides to get back to nature, throws on some muck boots, North Face jacket, and promptly invests in heritage breed livestock. So they just have, you know, it's like a happy meal. It's like, I'll take the fries and the burger and a small drink, please. It's the same story basically over and over.
It's very true. And the thing that makes them so effective is that there is a certain amount of pathos to them. Even in GMO OMG, the guy Jeremy Seifert was the director, and he did the movie on dumpster diving and food waste that I kind of liked. And when he did GMO OMG, he kind of did it from the standpoint of, I'm a dad. I'm worried about my two girls. He's got adorable kids, and I just worried about what they're eating. And so right away, you're on his side. You know, he's just a parent looking out for his family, but it was the misguided way that he succumbed to misinformation that was bad. But then when he created the hyperbole as a director by saying that, you know, his kids are going to go run through a GMO cornfield and put them in hazmat suits, you know, with the gas masks and everything else. And it turns out that the cornfield that they were using was non-GE sweet corn or something. It was all so debunked and so contrived, unfortunately, that it really made you lose the trust in the guy and made you think he was kind of slimy. But that was just my feeling.
Yeah, just crazy. Well, just a final thought so we can move on to our last story. But I think everybody agrees on the ends, you know, and for as much as Bayer or Monsanto, you know, as much as everyone hates them, and they have done things wrong in the past, there's no denying that. But if they made products that poisoned the earth and killed their customers, farmers, and killed consumers, that's just a bad business model. So even if you want to treat them as the most cynical evil institution on the planet, it's not in their best interest to poison everybody. But I don't think everyone's like that, really. I think, you know, everybody wants a clean environment and nutritious food. It's just trying to hone in on the details and make sure we're talking correctly about all the science.
Well, let me jump in on that. I mean, think about it this way too, that even if you don't like the companies or whatever, let's agree that they're greedy bastards that are just out to protect the bottom line. The last thing you're going to do is open yourself up to a lawsuit that's multi-billion-dollar lawsuit, right? Look at what Bayer's going through, and they didn't do anything wrong. I mean, this is, shareholders are suffering from a price that's been whacked down. The questions around the company's future are coming up because of what really was a legal grab, a money grab that was built around a class action lawsuit where the science is pretty solid that there's no connection to cancer. And the company in the lawsuit, in the settlement, said, we admit to no wrongdoing. So it was basically paying $10 million to make it go away. And so the last thing you're going to do is have evidence of damaging people with your products or the environment with your products, because, you know, and so that's always gives me more confidence that these are safe and good products that are problematic.
Yep. And just so if you want to find out about these documentaries, just go to the geneticliteracyproject.org and just type the name into our search bar. And there's all sorts of articles talking about these. And they're usually written by scientists, people that know what they're talking about. But let's move on, Kevin, and talk about GMO chestnut trees.
Oh, this is so cool. This is actually getting close to reality. And I remember hearing about this so long ago. So the American chestnut used to dominate the forests of the Appalachians, and it was something like 25% of all standing timber. And a fungus was introduced to, I think it was at the Bronx Zoo. They brought in a tree from China, and that tree now, I think it was China. Maybe I'm thinking of COVID. But anyway, I think it came in from China, and that tree brought in a fungus that then went ahead and infected the entire stand of American chestnut and knocked it back from one end of its northern range, which probably goes well into New Hampshire and Vermont, all the way down to the Georgia-Florida border possibly. That is gone. And so some researchers at University, Stanford, but it's the other one that begins with S, Syracuse. They came up with a way to solve this problem. And you could add a gene from wheat called oxalate oxidase. And that gene interferes with the way the fungus begins its attack on the chestnut. And so you've armed the tree with this oxalate oxidase enzyme. It's a naturally occurring enzyme. It's in wheat. We are exposed to it all the time. No allergies, nothing like that. And it gives the tree the ability to fight the fungus. Then they don't get chestnut blight. Well, these trees have been done for years. They work. They're looking great. And now they want to release them. And of course, here comes the pushback, right? And so there's a lot of people who are lining up to push back against the release of this chestnut. And during the public comment period, which just ended, there was significant activist pushback from the campaign to stop GE trees. And so here's a great example of how we're going to use technology to restore native conservation, native ecology, and yet there are people who want to stand in the way to block it.
By the way, everything we're talking about, you can read about it on the USDA's website. It's the Plant Health Inspection Service, I believe is what they're called. And let me get the university name right, because I always get it mixed up too. It's the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry. So in order to get this greenlit, it hasn't been approved yet, but they had to submit a request to the USDA for deregulation. And what these groups are doing is they're just trying to poke holes, very basic holes in the research behind these trees. And the funniest thing to me, and Kevin, you can comment on this more as a scientist, is that the concerns that they have are fundamental concerns that the USDA demands be addressed. And so they're addressed in the submission. It's very, very interesting. But jump in, and then we'll get into some details.
Well, when you read the pushback, whether it's – and you're right. It is the State University of New York. I can't believe that I get that wrong. I always think about it because I fly into that area, and I always fly into Syracuse. Anyway, it was when you read the pushback, it's all the same old tired arguments. And one of them that was – I don't remember where I read this, but it was in some of the – pushback said, you know, this is a gene you're putting into trees and putting into the environment. And they tested it for 5 years. But sometimes these trees take 200 years to colonize. We need to do much longer tests. It's like, really? We're going to check back with me in 2200 and we'll see where we are.
Yeah. And to me, that's a good indication that they're not sincere, that they don't want to find out. They just don't want you to do it. And here's a quote. This is actually from the campaign to stop GE trees, because they put out a press release when this was announced. And they said, one of the frequent problems is that engineering resistance to one pathogen often leaves plants more susceptible to other pathogens or reduces its growth significantly. And then they also talk about the problem of the pathogen building resistance over time. And, you know, so in other words, you put this gene in the tree, maybe its resistance lasts for 5 years or 10 years, but then it's gone. And to somebody who doesn't know anything about the topic, that is pretty convincing. But then when you go read the submission, the field trials that they did specifically looked at, does this affect growth? The answer is no, it does not. It's not a significant difference either direction, whether it's less growth or more growth. It doesn't impact it. And the same thing with the plant pest risk. There's no increased risk from other pests. And then the thing with the resistance is particularly interesting. And this is, and I don't want to read the quote. The quote's kind of long. But the point that they make is that because you're just giving the tree the ability to resist the fungus, you're not actually attacking the fungus. The fungus isn't very good at overcoming that resistance. And they can actually see this in the grasses that you were talking about, like wheat and right. barley. They have this same mechanism. And I didn't know this before. I'm glad I looked it up. The same mechanism that they're going to put into the tree, or that they've put into the tree, it exists in the wild. And the same pathogens that attack wheat, for example, they still have an evolved resistance to this. And we've been growing wheat for how many thousands of years? So suffice to say, I think they've looked into these, and they have a good case to make that this isn't going to be a problem.
Right, because it doesn't attack the fungus. It doesn't kill the fungus. It just doesn't allow the fungus to infect the tree. And so you're not selecting for, there's very low selection pressure on the fungus for it to develop resistance around. So that's the beauty. That's the beauty part of this. The other funny part about when you get into the resistance of this is they start bringing up things like indigenous people sovereignty, that they didn't, you know, agree to this. And, you know, I really see they're grasping at straws here to try to stifle a good technology.
And they address this also in the submission. This is interesting. I'll first point out that that has nothing to do with the technology itself. That's more of a property rights issue that you can resolve. And it could be anything in dispute. It doesn't have to be a genetically engineered tree. So that's the first thing. But the second point is that chestnut growers know how to prevent pollination of their trees. And I'm sure, Kevin, this is true for most crops, right? There are methods in place to prevent cross-pollination that you don't want. And it's pages and pages. They talk about this with academic citations. Mm-hmm. But effectively, they can stop that from happening. You know, they have, you know, it's whether it's distance or it's time of the year. I think there's a few different variables, but the point is they control that. You know, they know how to manage that. And this campaign against GE trees, whatever it's called, they don't mention this. I assume they have to know this, because even though they're opposed to it, they've probably read what's coming out of this USDA document. So I don't understand this. This is not hard to find the truth about this.
Yeah. And this is also a great example of a genetic engineering feat that is doesn't have a profit motive. It just wants to do the right thing. And it's a really great example to hold up. And I've loved this one for a long time. When you listen to Bill Powell talk about it, it's fantastic. He's been pushing this for a long time and almost riding the line where they would run out of money and couldn't keep the project going. So to see it get to kind of finality here is really exciting. And it is fun to go through the register of public comments, because it's clear that there are so many articulate, well-read people who understand this, who are out there making very good recommendations to the USDA. And it's really interesting to see. And when you see the anti-tree comments, it's the same old, same old. It's Monsanto just wants to make a profit, you know, and they're so wrong. But you see the same old over and over again.
Yeah, these are not Roundup ready trees, so farmers can spray glyphosate on them.
Right.
And Kevin, you pointed out at the beginning, these things are almost gone. So it's not like they're doing this in a vacuum just for funsies. You know, they are trying to solve a real problem. So it's not like we have plenty of these trees left and all we have to do is just leave them alone. They're being wiped out by this fungus. And it's not the only tree species. They want to do this kind of engineering work on elms and I think ash trees as well, because there's real threats out there to our forests. So it's a big deal. I think the comment period's closed, so people can't comment anymore. But start following this, you know, and you write your senator. I don't know.
It is a really good point, because we have a lot of crises in trees. You've got laurel wilt that's happening throughout the Southeast. You've got, the emerald ash borer and other insects that are problematic. Pine beetles. There are so many threats to forests, and to have a genetic solution that you can employ on the scale of a decade rather than breeding trees, which they are trying to breed a Chinese gene for resistance from the Chinese chestnut into the American chestnut. They're working on that. But that's going to take years to be able to do that. It's actually one of my former students doing that stuff. It's going to take a long time to get there. And so having this kind of agility to add a gene from wheat to be able to repatriate a forest with the appropriate trees that were there, that's pretty cool stuff.
Yes. And we could go on for days and days. So yeah, this is the start of something really big, hopefully. They're also using CRISPR, by the way, to edit poplar trees, I believe, to make paper production more sustainable. So there's all kinds of cool stuff in the works, but it seems like we have to get over this first hurdle if we can get, any of that other stuff into production. But let's leave it there. I could really keep talking about this, but I'll stop. Tell us about talking biotech, Kevin.
Yeah, so this week we're going to continue talking about gene editing. And if you didn't catch last week's, it got really good reviews by folks who gave me lots of nice comments. I went through the esteemed panel of folks against CRISPR and just kind of did a little bit of my commentary alongside of what they were saying. And really what they were saying is very much what they say against the tree. It's the same old tired arguments we've been listening to for 30 years, and technology will go ahead and do good things.
Very good. Check it out as always. Subscribe to the podcast, you guys, on iTunes and Spotify, if that's where you're listening. Give us 5 stars, because we love 5 stars. It validates us, makes us feel good. Thank you. And throw us $1 or $5 as a donation at the bottom of each episode if you like what we're doing and you want us to expand it and do more cool stuff in different formats. And also, we're on Twitter at CamJEnglish, at Kevin Folta. Leave your questions and comments, and we'll talk about them on the show. And we will see you next time.